The shiur today is going to be, hopefully, to the zchut that a person should have a refuah shleima, someone who is a friend of Matan, bracha bat Shifra, b'toch shor cholei Yisrael. Rabbi Gamliel famously said, in the first source, which is the Mishnah and Pesachim, which we all should recognize from the Haggadah. Rabbi Gamliel haya omer, kol shelo amar shlosha devrim elu bepesach, lo yatsa yedei chovato. Whoever didn't say three things on Pesach did not fulfill their obligation. The Elohein, and these three are they, Pesach, Matzah, Umoror. Which means the minimum of that a person needs to say on Pesach, or needs to say ostensibly to fulfill their obligation of Sipur Yitziat Mitzrayim. There is an opinion that we won't go into today that Rav Soloveitchik was fond of quoting, which is that the Ramban said that you don't fulfill the mitzvah of eating the Korban Pesach, or eating the matzah, or eating the maror, unless you know why you're doing it, and therefore he felt, this is Ramban, would be found in the end of, which is found in Brachot, and he felt that the obligation was not of Sipur, rather of Achila. But the normative interpretation is that it's Sipur, and consequently, what we need to do on Pesach is to explain these three things. Now, what I'm not sure of, and it doesn't make that much of a difference, I'm not sure about the next line in the Mishnah, which is very similar to the next line in the Haggadah, which says, Pesach al Shum, and then we have an interpretation. What I'm not sure of, if this is still Rabbi Gamliel speaking, or this is now a later strata of the Mishnah, of an interpretation of this is what we need to say. Either way, what we normally say is as follows. The Haggadah adds in some verses as well, which then anchors it within biblical texts. Pesach al shum shepasach hamakom abatei avoteinu b'mitzrayim. We eat the Korban Pesach because God passed over, quite literally, and hence the holiday Passover, when he struck the Egyptians and he saved the Jews. Matzah al shum shenig alu avotein b'mitzrayim. Matzah is because we were redeemed in Egypt. Now the verse which is quoted is a verse which is referred to in source number 2, that when we ate, when we left so quickly, we had no time. And we'll look at source number 2 for a second. V'yasu b'nei Yisrael mi Ramses Sukkota. The Jews left, they went from Ramses towards a place called Sukkot. K'shesh meot elef raglei agvarim levad mitaf. It gives us the amount of people. If you need another copy, here. And then Pasuk Lamed it says, V'yofu et habatzek asher hotziu mi Mitzrayim. They baked the dough which they took out of Egypt. Ugot matzot. They made ugot matzot. Now, what exactly is ugot matzot? We'll come back to. But how would you translate ugot matzot? Matzah cakes. Maybe this is why people think that matzot need to be round, but I'm not going to touch that. Kilo chametz, but it can't be made into chametz. Ki gershu mi Mitzrayim, for they were chased out of Egypt. V'lo yachlu litmameya, and they could not tarry. V'gam tzeida lo asu lahem, and they didn't have any provisions for them. So why do we eat matzah? Again, this is what we say by the Seder, correct? Why do we eat matzah? Because we left Egypt. We left so quickly, we had no time for the bread to rise. And finally, if we just go back for a moment, and maror, why do we eat maror? Al shum shemeru hamitzrim et chayei avotein mitzrayim. For the Egyptians, they made our lives quite bitter. So as I said, we're all familiar with this. And I just want to raise one very small issue. And of course, of this small issue, then we'll spend the rest of the class trying to deal with. Okay, it's not such a small issue, but there are most likely many, many answers to this. And you can ask this question, and I've asked this question, I've given answers, I've written answers about it. The question becomes, the earlier part of that chapter, of chapter 12, those of you who don't remember it, we read it on Shabbat. You don't remember it now, we read it again a couple months ago in Parshat Bo. What did it say in the beginning of the 12th chapter? And God spoke to Moshe and Aaron in the land of Egypt. What's the date? The date is more or less Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Vayomar Hashem Moshe ve'el Aharon be'eretz Mitzrayim le'mor ha'chodesh ze'lachem Rosh Chodeshim rishon hu lachem l'chodshei ha'shana. This is going to be the first month. So where are we right now? We're either right before or on Rosh Chodesh. Let's pay attention. Dabrul kol adat b'nei Yisrael. Speak to the entire congregation of Israel, saying, ba'asur l'chodesh, so it gives us the next frame of reference in terms of time. On the 10th of the month, you need to do something, and what's that? V'chul lahem ish se levet avot se lebayit. You all need to take your paschal lamb. Each home, each family will need, and it says to take it on the 10th. So what date are we now? No, we're not at the day. We're still... I see none of you make preparations for Pesach. Okay? These are preparations. This is before. This is the shopping list. Do any of you have a shopping list? Do you all have a shopping list you keep from one year to the next?
Yes.
Okay. Naomi, you're not alone. A lamb should be on the list. So it says on the shopping list, put a lamb. When should you take it? On the 10th of the month. Continue. And then it goes into details. You'll have enough people, not enough people. Invite your neighbors. Invite your sister-in-law if you have to. And then in Pasuk He, it describes what you should be taking. Pasuk Vav. V'hayalachem l'mishmeret. What do? You guard your sheep. Ad arba asayom l'chodesh hazeh. Guard it to the 14th. Now what date are we? We're still by Rosh Chodesh, telling what you should do on the 10th. Guard it to the 14th. V'shachatu al to kol kahal adat Yisrael bein harbayim. And it will be slaughtered on the 14th in late afternoon and the early evening. V'dachu min adam, you'll take the blood, v'nu al shtei hamizuzot, you put it on the doorpost, v'ala mashkof, ala batim asher yochlu oto bahem. In the homes that it will be eaten, you'll take the blood and you'll put it on the doorposts and whatever the top is called, I never remember. What's the top called?
Lintel.
I don't know. I just keep thinking that's kidney out, and I don't even say it. Ve'achlu et habasar balayla hazeh, and on that night, you're going to eat your paschal lamb. Tzli esh. How do you eat it? Roasted. Al ha'esh. Umatzot al mirurum yuchlu. And you eat it together with matzah and maror. So now, what is going to be on their shopping list on Rosh Chodesh Nisan? But, right? Have Pesach, have matzah, and have maror. Now, what's the slight problem with this? They didn't leave yet. This is 2 weeks before, which means the matzah that they ate that night. Again, let's not get confused. The next morning, they're going to leave, and they're going to leave so quickly. They're going to leave so quickly that they won't have time for their bread to rise. But the night before, they had time to prepare. And the night before, they had time to put together their shopping list. And the night before, they ate matzah, and they baked matzah, and they had matzahs put away, and they had matzahs prepared. And they had, just like, well, don't think you're special. Just like all of you have matzah before Pesach, they also had matzah before Pesach. And they ate the korban that night, Pesach, matzah, and maror. They ate it all together. And therefore, our explanation, at least when it comes to matzah, that we eat matzah because they left so quickly, we realize that there must be a little bit more to the story. Was that a fair analysis of what we've seen so far? And if you didn't follow anything else that I say the rest of today, at least you'll have a good question you can ask. And as we know, good questions are worth far more than good answers, or even mediocre answers. Good. Let's continue. The Medrash and Medrash Rabbah, I won't say it ignored Rabbi Gamliel, because it doesn't, but it does seem to ignore the second half of that Mishnah, or if not ignore it, it gives us an alternative narrative. In source number 4, V'lachu min adam v'nu al shnei mezuzot, sha'ani poseach aleichem, God speaks, put the blood on the doorpost and the whatever that's called, when I will go over those homes. Umagin aleichem, I will protect you. V'yu zihirimbo, shebelayla zeh nechal, Shenemar v'achlu ot basar b'layla hazeh tzli'esh, and that you'll eat the meat that night. Why? Bishvil Avraham. Oh, how did Avram get into this story? Shehitziltiv mikivshan ha'esh. Avram was also almost roasted. So here you see in black and white, the Medrash is telling us that why do we roast the Paschal lamb? Because Avraham was almost roasted. Umatzot, why do we eat matzot? And here we want some equality. We need to get a matriarch into the story as well. Bishvil Sarah. Sha'asta l'malchei hasharet ugot. Because she made, what did she make? She made matzah or? She made ugot. Now what the ugot has to do with Pesach is quite mysterious, but it says that she made ugot for the angels that came to visit. V'lo ta'amu lechem, and they didn't taste bread. Okay, which itself is quite strange. And why do we eat maror? Merurim b'shvil Yaakov. Shekeshem shenirdefu banav mitzrayim. Kach radfu Esav, that the experience and the feeling of persecution that the Jews had in Egypt is similar to the feelings of persecution that Yaakov had when he was being chased by his brother. As I said, you have over here in this Midrash a completely different narrative. What do you have here? Pesach, matzah, and maror. But what we see over here is a very interesting attempt in order to take earlier biblical stories and find a rationale for the Pesach, matzah, and maror. What I want to try to do is the same thing as the Midrash, but we'll do it by ourselves. And part of what we're going to try to figure out, and I realize that some of this may be fantasy and some of this may be reality, some of this may be references which the Jews that night understood or appreciated. Which means when they were told, take the Pesach, take the Matzah, take the Maror, what was going on in their heads? Now, if you want to tell me that what was going on in their heads is that they knew that they were going to leave so quickly tomorrow that they won't have time for the bread to rise, I'm willing to accept that answer. But that's a different class. Does matzah mean anything to them? Does the Pesach mean anything to them? Does the Maror mean anything to them? So let's try to look, and as I said, there's two possibilities. One is that this may be references that they would have appreciated, and the other possibility is, who cares about them? These are references that we will appreciate. Which means what I'm really looking for is biblical antecedents of the Pesach Matzah Maror, or biblical context of what symbol or what meaning these things would have had. So let's start with the simplest thing. And those of you who have been to my classes over the years know that somehow, inevitably, we end up getting back to Gan Eden no matter what. The name of my next book, which is coming out, is going to be called Echoes of Eden, which I think will be appropriately named. In source number 5, this is before the sin, Ve'yikach Hashem Elokim et ha'adam v'yinecheh b'gan Eden la'ovda u'lishamra. Man was placed in the Garden of Eden to do what? It says to work and to guard. And afterwards, after the sin and things go bad, in source 6, Ula Adam Amar, Ki shamata l'kol ishtecha, v'tuchal min ha'etz asher tziviticha, le'mor lo tuchal mimenu, arura ha'adama ba'avurecha, the earth will be cursed, be'itzvon tachlen kol yimechayacha, and you will eat out of sadness. V'kotz v'dardar tatzmiach lach, thorns and thistles will grow, V'chalta et esev hasadeh, and that's how you will eat. What is the esev hasadeh? What does esev mean? The greens. The greens, good. The greens of the field. And it continues, bezat apecha tochalechem, and with the sweat of your brow you will eat bread, and so on. We have actually over here two elements, which, actually two out of our three elements. We have bread. I know you'll tell me, but bread and matzah are different. Well, they're not all that different. They have some very similar ingredients. That in order to have bread, you need to work, and the greens that you will eat will emerge out of pain and sadness. Rashi, in source number 7, which refers to eating the matzah with the maror, Rashi describes maror as, what is it? Kol esev mar, nikra maror. What is maror? Maror is a green which is bitter, a bitter green. I know that most of us have been brought up eating horseradish. Horseradish may or may not be maror. I don't want to tell you after all these years that it's possible that it's not maror, but what I will tell you is that it's quite unlikely that they ate maror when they were in Israel over the years, because maror simply did not grow in that area. Maror is something which we found in our along the way in our exiles, in cold places in Europe. According to most of the, and you know what, even before I say most of the opinions, horseradish is not bitter. Horseradish is sharp. They make wasabi out of horseradish. That's not bitter. If you eat various vegetation, including types of lettuces, those are bitter. What did Rashi say over here? Matzot almarurim, kol esev mar nikra maror. It's a generic term for any type of bitter herb. And now I'll go back and I'll ask you, and where was the first time that they're told about a bitter herb that they will eat? The first time really is when they're exiled of the Garden of Eden, which is interesting because this is the first exile. Egypt, of course, marks the end of the first exile for the Jewish people as a collective, but over here, already in the Garden of Eden, we have a reference to this, and we also have a reference to something else that perhaps we didn't think of. Matzah is itself multifaceted. The Gemara says that. The Gemara doesn't know what to do exactly with the word, with the term lechem oni, or the word oni. It's spelled one way, pronounced another way. Is it ani? Is it oni? And the Gemara ends up saying that this is multifaceted bread. Lechem sha'onim dvarim harbe. It is a type of bread that has many things which are explained about it. And for that matter, it can end up being both a bread of affliction and a bread of liberation. It's both. And now I'll go back and I'll ask you again, and where is the first time that we find a bread of affliction, a reference to bread of affliction? We find it right over here within this narrative when Adam is being told that now to have bread to eat, it will be by the sweat of his brow. This will now become the bread of affliction. So now, do the Jews in Egypt have a strong enough tradition that they know the narratives of the Garden of Eden, and they know exactly what took place there? You can say yes or you can say no, but either way, we don't know. Maybe yes, maybe no. You want some wine into the story? It's very easy to connect the Garden of Eden and the tree of knowledge of true of good and evil together with vines. That is the kind of fruit that confuses you between good and evil. You want your four cups of wine, you can throw them in also over here, but we're not talking about that today. Where's the first time that we actually find matzah? This is bread of affliction, but where's the first time in the Torah we find matzah? What's the answer? There's the right answer and the wrong answer. What's the wrong answer first? Okay, I don't know is also a good answer. Avraham, good, that's the wrong answer. So the first time that we find matzah is by Avraham. There's only one problem in the text with Avraham, and that is it doesn't say anything about matzah. It says there, correct, it says ugot. It says ugot. If you look at source number 8, Vayimaher Avraham ha'ohela, Avraham rushed to the tent, El Sarah to Sarah, Vayomer, and he said to her, Mahari shalush si'im kemach. Is that shalush? Right, Kemach? Solet lushi va'asi ugot. He tells her, make ugot. What are ugot? So again, we decided that that's cake or cookies. But it doesn't sound like matzah. Now, Rashi, based on the Medrash, will tell you that this is matzah. I mean, if you look at source number 9, on this verse, Rashi says, va'asi ugot. Sorry, this is not Rashi, this is the Medrash Rabbah. Hada amart pras ha-pesachava. And now you know it was the season of Passover. The motivation for the Medrash is actually based on something else. And Rashi doesn't say it by the matzah. Rashi says it by a different point within the narrative. And that is when the angels say, next year at this time, you will have a child, we have a tradition that Yitzchak is born on Pesach. There's many reasons for this tradition, but I think the simplest one is that in order to explain the 400 years that Avraham was told about, your descendants will be enslaved for 400 years. We know that the slavery did not last 400 years, but Rashi says it's 400 years from when? From the birth of Yitzchak. So therefore, Yitzchak needs to be born on Pesach. Okay, and as I said, there is the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah has a whole list of arguments regarding biblical chronology, all kinds of events. The one thing which even Rabbi Lez and Rabbi Yeshua are unanimous about, or in agreement, is regarding the birth of Yitzchak, which is on Pesach. So therefore, if Yitzchak is born on Pesach, then it has to be Pesach time. So if it's Pesach time, would Sarah Imeni, she was a Jewish woman, she must have kept a kosher home. So how could it be that she would be making something other than matzah? So therefore they say, obviously she must have been making matzah. What's the one problem with that? One is it doesn't say it. One is it doesn't say it. All the other problems you can tell me about, but one is it doesn't say it. But then conveniently, and this is what the Midrash is really picking up on, when matzah was described the first time, how was it described? Ugot matzot. What is it that she makes? She makes ugot, so therefore, okay, it must be ugot matzot. Now, was that easy? Go like this. No, that was not all that easy. Mahari. Okay, that's good. We could just be obsessive Jewish men. It doesn't... That's good. On the other hand, when really is matzah mentioned the first time? Right. In the narrative of Lot, you do find matzah. And now you can go backwards again. And where would Lot learn about matzah from? He had to have learned it because he grew up in Avraham's home. He grew up in a religious home. So obviously he knew about matzah because he learned about it from Avraham. And then once again, you're back to Avraham as the source, which may be a further motivation to have Sarah's Ugo to be kosher l'Pesach. Anachronistic. That's only if you look at things in a certain way. No, it's fine. Rationalists are invited. However, that's the first feeling that I would have also when I talk about Lot celebrating Pesach, because it's obviously absurd. It has nothing to do with anything. The only thing is, upon further contemplation, and I'm not going to do this at length today, because I've given classes about this in the past, and some of you are looking and say, oh, he already spoke about that. But I will do it very quickly. And if you want, you can email me, and I'll direct you in an article I wrote about this, or you can buy my book, and then we can retire. I'm just kidding about retiring. Not yet. But in my book on holidays, I do have an article, an essay about the matzah of Lot. But if you look at source number 10, I was so nice to you. I even bolded some of the English. Over here you have Lot sitting around in stone. And as he's sitting there, he gets guests. And Lot is a good host. Why would he be a good host? Because he grew up in a Jewish home, and he learned from Avraham and Sarah. And he sees his guests, and what does he say to them? He says, come in. Look at Pasuk Bet. I love his invitation. I'm very sympathetic. Vayomer hinena Adonai, surina el beit avdechem. Come, sir, come into the home of your servant. V'linu, what does linu mean? V'rachatzu, raglechem, what does that mean? Wash up, wash your feet. V'hishkamtem, v'halachtem, and get up and go. You know what? Guests don't always know when to leave. And here we have Lot. This is wonderful. Lot says, you come and get out. Now, why would Lot want his guests to get out? So now you can start telling me all kinds of things about the behavior of Sodomites and how they don't like this type of thing, they don't like people inviting them, and so on and so forth. But he does say get out, and if you said Mahari before, the sense of speed that he's speaking about is very interesting. And then they say they don't want to come, and finally he talks them in. Vayifatzer behem, he insists they come in. Vayisuri lo vayivo beto, vayas lahem mishteh, umatzot afa vayachelu. He invites them for a feast, And he makes the matzah and they eat. Now, why would he make the matzah? Because it's fast food. Okay? It's not the kind of fast food that will kill you, although I can't test what matzah will do to you. He insists on matzah because it's fast. That's part of his previous verse when he says, and get out. We then have a couple of references, and again, we're going to do this quickly. The whole people come, minarva ad zakein, which is a phrase that you'll find from the Passover narrative. They all come to the door of his household. You'll be very hard-pressed to find another example where we talk about a doorway, when there's a whole fight that takes place by the doorway. The next time we find a doorway of significance is, of course, the doorway of putting the blood on the doorposts. Afterwards, what happens to the people that are trying to push open the door? They get blinded, which is wonderfully close to Makat Choshech. Of course, they get blinded by the light instead of. And if you continue reading through this whole narrative, you will find, depending how well you read, 10 to 15 different comparisons or contrasts to leaving Egypt. As I said, you want to read what I wrote, I'll be happy to send it to you. If you read Pasuk Yud Gimel, it's also very close. Ki mashchitem anachnu et hamakom hazeh, ki gadlo tzaakatam b'fnei Hashem. The cry is great in front of God. That's also a verse you should recognize. And then you get to Pasuk Tet Zayin, which you can't help but notice. What do the angels say? You got to leave quick. Which means this should be really the same way that we leave Egypt. How do we leave Egypt? Quickly. But what does Lot do instead? Vayitma meha. And I hope you recognize that word as well. But this is the exact, as I said, comparisons and contrasts. Over here, Lot takes his time. Also, the angels say, don't look back. By Egypt, we're told later on also, you're not supposed to go back this way. And of course, Lot's wife does look back and does not work out very well. So what do we see from this? We see that the first reference to matzah is by Lot, is in stone, which means that it's probably a biblical indication that one should go to the Dead Sea for Pesach. What? It's not going to work. Okay. We do find something which is interesting, and that's source number 11. And source number 11 continues the narrative to what happens next, and it doesn't work out all that well. Lot ends up secluded with his daughters who have all kinds of plans, and the next thing they know, Lot fathers two nations. And one of these nations is Moab, which is aptly named, Moab, from my father. And the Midrash tells us in Source 11, and we'll read the last couple of words in it, Amar Rav Yitzchak, the last line in Source 11, Matsati David Avdi, I found my servant David. Now, some of you may be thinking you didn't know that David was lost. Where was David found? Hechad Matsativ Bistom. That the origin of David is in stone. Now that, of course, is true technically. How so? Because this is the first, right? Wrote, right? David comes from Moab, or his great-grandmother Ruth was from Moab. And now it has to, you know, uncomfortably for us at least, point out that David comes from stone and comes from this relationship. I mean, apparently his daughters went to the Beis Yaakov of stone and they taught all kinds of sodomite behavior over there. What's interesting about this is that the Midrash is trying to connect the final redeemer and the final redemption as starting in stone. But I think that this also, in a sense, is the first redemption. How is this the first redemption? Here you have a city which is going to be destroyed. You have a plague which really comes and strikes them in terms of the blindness, which, as we saw, is close to Choshech. Lot then is taken out of the city, which will then, as I said, be destroyed. And we have Yitziat Lot Mistom. Now, one thing which is very interesting about this, why is Lot saved? And there's two possibilities why he's saved. One is he saved because of Avraham. Because we really don't know how Avraham's prayers ended up working out. We don't know if they worked or if they didn't work. But it seems to be that Lot is saved because of Avraham. And later on, before this, we found another narrative where Lot is saved because of Avram. Avram actually has to go to war to save him. Lot is saved because of Avraham. And I can say, now, why were the Jews saved in Egypt? The Jews weren't saved in Egypt, especially if you take the teachings of the Zohar, popularized by the Arizal, which is that they reached the 49th level of Tumah. Everybody quotes that teaching. It's not in any Gemara or any Midrash. The Jews had reached the 49th level of Tumah, of impurity. And why were they saved? They were saved because God made a covenant. What was the covenant with Avraham? Right. What's the covenant? You're going to be enslaved for 400 years and then I'm going to take them out. So God's going to take them out. And if they're about to slip too far, what does God have to do? He has to keep his word and take them out. Which means Lot being saved from Sodom and the Jews being saved from Egypt come for the same reason. And I can say that there's another reason. What's the other reason that Lot may be saved? Maybe because of his own personal mitzvah that he did. What mitzvah did he do? He did the mitzvah of chesed. Now, did he do this in the best possible way? Well, not necessarily. Is Lot a little bit morally challenged? Absolutely. I mean, they come and they want to come and take the guests, and he goes, take my daughters instead. Which, by the way, unless the people of Sodom really were all homosexual and he was mocking them, and say, take my daughters. No man has ever known them. Which I'm saying that is also a possibility within the narrative there. But I said we're not going to go into this more than necessary. Of course, the next question would be then how did they survive? Which would not be all that simple. But Lot does one mitzvah, and he does it in a very imperfect fashion. What mitzvah is that? Hakhnasat Rachim. He doesn't do it that well. We're not all that impressed with Lot. Lot is an Avram wannabe. Lot, instead of living in Avram's tent, and let's not make any mistake about this, he can either live in the tent of the greatest man in the world, or he can become the chief rabbi of Sodom. He chooses the latter. I mean, there really is something very pathetic about Lot and therefore about his choice, but he does one mitzvah, albeit imperfectly. For that, Lot may be saved. If the Jews really did sink to the 49th level of Tum'ah, and God says to Moshe, now tell them that they're going to be saved, and says, now tell them, take the Korban Pesach and take the matzah. And matzah, now again, if they have some kind of a collective memory that there was matzah when Lot was saved from Sodom, that then becomes in their mind that you know what, it's possible. It is possible they're going to leave. You know what, let's think about this a little differently. Sometimes we all have this feeling, how could a redemption ever take place in our generation when we have earlier generations not that long ago where you had a far greater percentage of Jews than today who kept Shabbat, who kept Kashrut, and so on. And we say, how could it possibly be today that we could get towards redemption? And then you hear that Lot was saved for doing one mitzvah completely imperfectly. And you know what? At that point, it may make a little bit of sense that even we could be saved, even if we do less mitzvot, we don't do them as well, we do them imperfectly. Redemption then makes sense. Which I'm saying, matzah as a symbol of the saving of Lot from Sodom may have been very important to the people. And at that point, maybe for the first time, they realize, you know what? We really will be leaving Egypt. So as I said, that reference, even if they didn't get it, we get it. And as I said, there's too much over here to say that there's no connection whatsoever. It starts with the matzah, but it's not just the matzah. There are, again, all these other elements. But let's try to do this a little bit sharper even. Instead of going to biblical stories that maybe nobody remembers or nobody knew, there were stories which were a lot closer to Egypt. A matter of fact, there's a story as to how the Jews got down to Egypt. Which means, when does the whole slavery in Egypt begin? And there's many dates that you can choose. I choose to look at source number 12. We have this terrible tragedy of Yosef traveling along, thinks he's going north, correct? He starts by Chevron. He thinks he's heading towards the area of Shechem. And lo and behold, what happens? His brothers are no longer there. They went to Dothan. He now is going to Dothan. And where does he end up going? He ends up on the express all the way to Egypt, which sort of pushes us in this direction that that's where God wanted him to go. I mean, that's certainly the meaning of the anonymous man that he meets in the field. I mean, you ask yourself sometimes, what if he didn't bump into him? So he would have looked for his brothers, didn't find them, and come home. But instead, God wanted him in Egypt. He was going to get to Egypt one way or the other. Yosef, for his part, what does he say? Vayomer et achai anochi mevakesh. And that's sincere. Yosef wants his brothers. That line never changes. For the rest of his life, that line never changes. Yosef really does want his brothers. Yosef is loved and respected by everybody he meets, except for one group of people, and that's his brothers. His brothers, on the other hand, see him coming from afar, and they start to plot to kill him. Now, all this right now has nothing to do with Egypt, except for one thing, and what's that? This is the beginning. And if this is the beginning, then maybe it does have something to do with it. They throw Yosef in the pit because they have some moral issues about killing him. So what do they do instead? They're going to sell him. Pasuk Kaf Dalet. V'yikacheyu v'yishlichu oto habora v'aborekin b'mayim. And what do they then do? V'yishvu le'echol lechem. And they sit down to break bread. Now this is also one of these things that maybe you never really paid attention to. Okay, they had to do something when Yosef was in the pit, so it was time for lunch, so they had lunch. But bread, lechem, is another theme which is going to punctuate the entire story of Yosef. I don't know if you've ever paid attention to how many references there will be to bread along the way. But let's just think for a moment that when the Jews are going to go down into Egypt, they sit together as a family and have bread, although I'll correct myself, they almost sit as a family and have bread. There's, of course, one person who's missing. How interesting is it that when God tells Moshe that you're going to have a meal before you leave, and you're going to eat matzah, and he says, and gather together as your family. And not just gather as your family, even invite that extended family. And even invite that person who you're thinking of right now of not inviting, he's saying, and invite them. Because the beginning of the slavery is because of us feeling that we were not a family. And the beginning of the slavery is when they're sitting and eating bread, but Yosef is in the pit. At the end of the story, when we leave, they're going to sit together as a family and eat matzah, but we're going to eat maror also, because there is something very bitter over here which has taken place. But let's continue. If we want to see lechem in more places in the story, it comes in expected places and comes in very unexpected places. For example, in source 13, Potiphar's wife is referred to as bread. Is that clear or is that not clear? It says, "Vayazov kol asher lo biyad Yosef." He left everything in Yosef's hand. V'lo yodai to me'uma ki malechem asher ochel, except for the bread that he ate. Later on, when Mrs. Robinson Potiphar tries to seduce Yosef, Yosef responds and he says in Pasuk Tet, "Einini gol b'bayit hazeh mimeni v'lo chasach mimeni me'uma ki im otach." Nothing was held back except for you. And what did it say two verses later? Nothing was held back except for the bread that he eats, which then can cause you to think that maybe the bread is there some type of euphemism. In fact, it's quite interesting because the orientation to the Egyptians towards bread is not all that simple, but I'll get to that in a moment. Take a look at source number 15. Of course, you don't see any bread over there. It's in Paro's dream. What does he dream of? He dreams of cows and, what's the other thing? Wheat. It wasn't corn, most likely. It's wheat. And what do you do with wheat? I know you make ugot, right? You make bread. So it's right there as a theme. And a matter of fact, what did Yosef dream of? Sheaves. Also wheat, which means the difference. Matter of fact, there was another dream over there. Right? The person who baked, which means you start thinking now and you realize, hold it, there's much more bread. Again, right all the way through, we have our wheat, bread, and so on, going right through this story, and we have to then ask ourselves again, so what exactly is this doing here? In source 16, and by the way, that the cows were beautiful. Who else was described as beautiful in that same area? Is Yosef, which I'm saying there's also something very interesting. But between the cows and the bread, the two dreams of Paro, there may be a much deeper connection between these two dreams. But let's go on a little bit and we'll see it. In source 16, we have another Seder taking place, or at least it's another family meal. The entire family is together. This one's even better than the last one. The last one, the whole family was together, except for Yosef, because they threw him in the pit. Now the whole family is there, including Yosef, including Binyamin, but there's one problem. They don't know that it's Yosef. And what do they all do? They sit down to eat bread. But the Egyptians all move away. Now, why do the Egyptians move away? Look at source 16. V'yusimu lo levado v'lehim levadam v'lemitzrayim ochlim ito levadam ki lo yuchlun amitzrim lechol eta ivrim lechem ki to'eva hi lemitzrayim. For the bread is a to'eva. Now, what does the word to'eva mean? What does it mean generally? What does it mean over here? What is abomination, disgusting? It's not clear why this would be at all an abomination. Let's continue. What's also interesting is you have a couple of cups of wine over here in this meal that they have together. It says v'yishtu v'yishikru imo. They sat and they did drink together with Yosef. You have a question?
Yes, if you don't mind. Is it the bread that is a to'eva, or is it eating with them?
Depends which commentaries you look at. Let's continue and look at source 17. The word to'eva is used again when Yosef prepares his brothers to speak to Paro. And what are they supposed to say to him? That we are shepherds. This is after the whole story is over. Why should he say that we're shepherds? Ki to'avat Mitzrayim kor etzon. That all shepherds were an abomination to Egypt. Now there are those commentaries that the word to'eva mean over here means something that you don't think it means. And you can really get this already from the Targum. The Egyptians worshipped animals. The Ibn Ezra tells us it's sort of like in India. He says, until our very day. Look at Rashi. Rashi doesn't say anything about India, but Rashi says it very succinctly. Ki to'avat Mitzrayim, l'fishahim lahim elohut. For they are for the Egyptians a god or a deity. Deity. Now, it's possible that when it says ki to'eva, what it's referring to is it's a reference to the gods of Egypt. That the Torah is making a value judgment and telling you that, well, when we make reference to the gods of Egypt, that is something which is a to'eva. And that's why the word to'eva is used. Now, being that the word to'eva was used twice within, you know, this, again, it's one section, really, there are those then who will then try to combine the two together. If you look at the commentaries on the early verse in terms of the bread, they will tell you that. What exactly the connection is, it's not clear. But apparently the Egyptians, there is something about the bread that is also some kind of a deity involved in this. It's possible because that's the food which the animals ate. It's possible. But it's very strange the behavior that we see is that they will not do this with the Jews, with the Israelites. They need to be separate when they eat their bread. We see that the Jews need to be separate when they have their flock. The Ramban, and this is a very expected place, back in Perek Yud Bet, back when we're told to eat the matzah with the maror, back when we're told to eat the Korban Pesach, the Ramban tells us in source 19, Ish said levet avot, tam hamitzvah hazot, the reason for this commandment, now you think that what he's about to tell you, source 19, you think what he's about to tell you is because when God passed over, they put the blood and so on. The Ramban doesn't tell us this. The Ramban says, Tam ha-mitzvah hazot, the reason that we have this mitzvah of eating the Korban Pesach, ki mazal teleh b'chodesh nisan b'kocho hagadol. Those of you who don't know that much about your astrology, that the teleh is in power at this time. And therefore, the Ramban tells us very clearly, Ki hamazal hatzomeach lekach tziva l'shchot tale ulecholoto. We are therefore commanded to kill the god of the Egyptians and to eat it. The Radak says the same thing. For amu shayu ovdim mazal taleh lafichach lo yu ochlim shum basar behema, which means that's the reason the Egyptians wouldn't eat. They were all vegetarians. Anybody who's looking for a biblical source of vegetarians, here you have it. The Egyptians were vegetarians. Hitler was also a vegetarian. I don't want to insult any vegetarians. I like vegetarians. No, not some of my best friends. All of my food is vegetarian. Cows don't eat other cows. Anyway. Somebody once got upset with something that I wrote about eating meat. And he was a vegetarian and a prominent vegetarian. And he wrote me and he says, weren't Adam and Eve vegetarians in the Garden of Eden? Shouldn't we also be? I said, they also walked around naked. What's your point? And that was... No, but seriously, the Egyptians were told were vegetarian. The Ibn Ezra has said this as well. Both the Ramban and the Radak and the Ibn Ezra and all these other commentaries that you can look at are based upon a very clear rabbinical source in source 21. Amar lo Kadosh Baruch Hu Moshe, Kol Zman Yisrael Ovdim LeElohei Mitzrayim Lo Yigalu. As long as we are involved in the idolatry of the Egyptians, we will not be saved. God says it. Again, this imagery of the 49th level of Tumah, if we're still worshipping their idols, we will not be able to leave. Lech v'amor lehem she'anichu ma'aseim hara'im. Tell them they have to stop their behavior. U'lechfor b'avodat ha'kochavim. They have to deny it. Mashchu v'kachu lechem klomar. Mashchu yedeichem b'avodat ha'kochavim. Clean your hands from idolatry. And take from the flock and kill their gods. Elohim shel Mitzrayim. Vasu ha-Pesach. And that's what the Korban Pesach is. And that's the reason that God is going to pass over you and save you. Which means, and again, this is much more serious in terms of a reason why we would eat the Korban Pesach. Because this is something that the Jews living in this society would have understood. They know that the Egyptians worship these things. They know that these things are considered to be gods. And we can say very softly, and it's possible that the Jews themselves also worship these things until fairly recently. And therefore, this is really their declaration of independence, not just from Egypt. It's their declaration of independence from the gods of Egypt. And don't underestimate how the gods of Egypt come into this story. God himself says, and I will judge the gods of Egypt. We're told that one of the things they worship was the Nile. Three of the first four plagues, the Nile was struck. The Nile turning into blood was probably an unbelievable image. When you see the things coming out of the Nile to plague them, how was that taken by the Egyptians and how was that understood by the Jews? The last three plagues, all of elements of darkness to them. The Egyptians worshipped Ra, which was the sun god. When there's no more light, there's darkness. When in the middle of the night, the firstborn is struck. Darkness comes in. Three of the last four. When you see the whole place gets covered and they no longer can see anything, the sun is no longer powerful. And there are degrees over here. Which means the Jews in that context would have understood these elements far better than we do today. Because we hear that there was a frog. There was a frog. Was it a big frog? It was a little frog. Lots of frogs. And we're just stuck on frogs. And we have no idea. We don't pay attention to the symbolism. Oh, those frogs all came out of the Nile? That's very significant. They thought the Nile was a god. Pharaoh told people he is the god of the Nile. And now the Nile's rebelling against them. That's very significant. Which means we don't necessarily appreciate what they would have appreciated when they sat down for their Seder. Do you know what it would have been like? And let's put some of the things together. If that night they're told to take bread, and what do the Egyptians think about bread? Well, not all that much. There's also some issue of a deity involved. You take the bread, and if we'll imagine this like Hillel, which is my favorite commentary on the Haggadah. What does Hillel say? You eat it all together. Now, what did Hillel do? He made a shawarma. That's what Hillel did. Because now you all understand that the matzahs were round, but they were soft. I mean, today they cook them at such heats, at such temperatures. They never did this in history. They cook today the matzahs for around 4 seconds. They get burnt just about immediately. If any of you have any Yemenite blood in you, The Yemenites eat soft matzah, which looks remarkably like an esh tanur, which they have the shawarma in. When he says that you eat them together, you take the esh tanur, you take the korban pesach, you put it together. Oh, what's more? What did we decide that was?
Greens.
You roll this together, and what do you have? We shouldn't even call it a shawarma. We should call it a hillel. This is. And when they sat and they ate this together, there's some wonderful symbolism which is taking place. They are going against the Egyptian sensitivities in terms of eating bread together as a family with Jews. On the other hand, what are they doing? They have slaughtered the Egyptian god. Must have been very cathartic as well to take the blood and put it on the doorposts. They're eating the god of the Egyptians, showing this has no power on us, this has no force on us. But they have to eat it together with the Mar, because there is still some bitterness. And why would there be any bitterness involved? We should just be leaving. It should be liberation. Why should there still be bitterness? Because hopefully every single one of them who today are sitting together with their entire family, their extended family, should know that when they came down to Egypt, they did not sit as a family. That when they came down to Egypt, they rejected part of the family. And the reason they all ended up down in Egypt was because they thought they sold Yosef to Egypt. And again, that's the beautiful irony of the Torah, is that we think that we're selling our brother to slavery. Little do we realize that we ended up selling ourselves into slavery. It wasn't just Yosef who ended up there. The brothers came very quickly. And why did they come? Because what were they looking for? They were looking for bread. Which means the element of bread is a part of this entire story of going down into Egypt. And Yosef, what does he do? He doesn't get to share the bread with them in the beginning, and he doesn't partake of the bread of Eshet Potiphar. That's not his bread. Yosef has a whole better vision in terms of bread, and he dreams about this from the very beginning in terms of the stalks. He understands the dreams, he interprets the dreams, but there is still a tragedy involved in this, which means that even when we are going to eat the Korban Pesach and the matzah, and maybe they still do remember, maybe they remember that the Egyptian that Lot was saved just because of the matzah. Maybe they do remember this. They still need to have something bitter. They need to have something bitter from that very vestige, from that very, very first exile. Because as long as man can treat one another the way that we did, we will continue to go into exile. And now when we leave Egypt, we can't ignore how we got down to Egypt. And that's the bitter herbs involved as well. Which means that night in Egypt, not today, that night in Egypt, when they sat and they had the Korban Pesach, and they had it with matzah, and they had it with maror, I think all of these elements were incredibly symbolic for them. Once we leave, the matzah takes upon a whole new facet to it. Once we leave, we left so quickly the matzah had no time to rise. Once we leave, we can look at these things somewhat differently. But that doesn't take away the symbolism, which I think they would have all had understood within context. Bizrat Hashem, all of us will, except the vegetarians will be happy, but Bizrat Hashem will all have an opportunity to eat the Korban Pesach together with the matzah, together with a little bit of maror, and we can all really experience complete redemption. Chag Sameach.